KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Doing something about global warming is no longer the sole preoccupation of environmentalists. It's a mainstream cause embraced by politicians of all stripes. Witness this week's inclusion of that topic in President Bush's State of the Union address. In the hour ahead, we're going to survey the current global warming landscape. What are the most promising policy initiatives? How achievable are California's landmark new standards? And what are the consequences if we fail or if we succeed? A global warming status report. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. A lot has been happening on the global warming front in recent days. Just yesterday, as reported earlier on NPR News this morning, California's Public Utilities Commission voted to bar the state from buying electricity that comes from high-polluting sources, part of the state's overall push to reduce greenhouse gases. President Bush, whose administration has long seemed skeptical of global warming, put forward his own ideas on energy conservation and climate change in this week's State of the Union address. And on the same day as the president's address, An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's movie about climate change, received an Academy Award nomination. Does all this mean that the stars are finally aligned for progress on the global warming front? In the hour ahead, we want to take a step back from all of these different developments and try to provide a kind of status report on what's going on. What policy initiatives will make a difference and which won't? Which will give us the most energy bang for the investment buck? For example, is an increased investment in ethanol, as the president proposed, a good idea? Is there a need for universal emission caps, or should states like California just go their own way? And as plans and legislation inch forward in Sacramento and in Washington, what should individual California farmers, business people, and citizens do in the meantime? Joining us to gain some perspective on this topic, Severin Bornstein. He's director of the Energy Institute at the University of California, Berkeley, and a professor in the Haas School of Business. Professor Bornstein, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well, Terry Tamminen. He's Governor Schwarzenegger's former secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency, an environmental consultant, and the author of Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction. Mr. Tamminen, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
Happy to have you with us. With us, too, is Vicky Arroyo. She's Director of Policy Analysis for the Pew Center for Global Climate Change. She joins us this morning from Arlington, Virginia. Ms. Arroyo, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks all for being with us. I'd like to begin by asking you each to sort of put things in a bit of perspective for us. There has been so much going on, whether it's at the state level here in California, the President's State of the Union address, the changes in Congress. All of these things now seem to be circulating that have elevated this topic to a new level. Severin Bornstein, first, as you look at all of these developments, what to you is the most significant thing, the thing that you think may make a difference as we approach this topic?
Well, I think we have to start by recognizing what was and was not in the State of the Union address. Although it is getting played as a change, I think actually there's very little content that was aimed at climate change in the president's address. Most of what he was talking about when he talked about energy was about energy independence, that is reducing our use of oil, and that's often confused with climate change. But for instance, the move to ethanol would have very little effect on reducing CO2 emissions. The evidence is real clear on that. It would reduce our use of oil, but it would substitute other fossil fuels that end up producing nearly as much CO2. So I think that it's really not accurate to see the president's changes or moves in the State of the Union address as an attempt to address climate change.
Even though he actually said the words themselves.
He did say the words climate change almost as an afterthought that this would also affect climate change. And it potentially could. Certainly raising fuel economy standards would help reduce our use of fuel and would help reduce our production of CO2. The goal he set for raising fuel economy standards is so modest, however, to be almost a joke. A 5% improvement in fuel economy over more than a decade is not any challenge at all to the industry, and certainly something we could certainly achieve something much further than that. So I think that we have to recognize that this administration is not making serious steps towards addressing climate change. The Congress certainly is going to push in this direction, but there's a tremendous amount of resistance from industry, which now is starting to accept the concept of controlling CO2 emissions, but at the same time is circling, trying to figure out how they each group can get as much of the tradable permits as possible.
Vicky Arroyo, on that point, you were part of a new coalition of both people in the oil-producing arena and in the business arena, as well as environmental groups. Is there beginning to be a sort of sea change, as Severin Bornstein indicates, in the way in which this topic is now being viewed by the energy industry?
I think it's fair to say that this month we're seeing all kinds of changes that are really hopeful, although I agree with his skepticism about the commitments in the State of the Union really translating into much of a climate benefit. But we did see on Monday 10 CEOs of major companies, you know, household names like GE, DuPont, coal-burning utilities like Duke Power and PNM, saying that we need action on climate change and that they're willing to support mandatory cap and trade, something that restricts the pollutants that come from their facilities and allows them to trade with others.
Vicky Arroyo is Director of Policy Analysis for the Pew Center for Global Climate Change. She joins us this morning from Arlington, Virginia. Terry Tamminen joins us as well from Santa Monica. He's the governor's former secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency. Terry, how do you see this in terms of the consequence or importance of the various levels of activity we've seen on all these different fronts that we're describing?
Well, let me give the good news first, which is that states like California are moving aggressively when you look at the fact that California is the sixth largest economy on the planet, that makes a difference. And as we've seen with environmental regulation in the past, if California moves, other states tend to do the same thing. And actually, since I've officially left state government, I continue to work with Governor Schwarzenegger and other governors on a bipartisan effort across the country to get more states to adopt California-style programs and policies and legislation. And I think you're going to see this year a good 10 to 15 states adopting very aggressive climate plans and passing legislation of their own, probably several more the following year, so that by the time we get a new administration in Washington that might actually understand or care about these issues, there will be a national climate plan, but cobbled together at the state level, which then will be fertile ground, I'd say, for the feds to take action to stitch all of that together and add value. But I would echo the comments of my colleagues so far, which is that clearly the president was not serious when he said, and his quote was, we must confront the serious challenge of global climate change. But when he talked about what he was going to do, the first thing he said was, we have to incentivize clean coal. And so far, that continues to be an oxymoron, although there's promising research going on. But he then went on to talk about wind and solar and nuclear. And as Severin said, when he then talked about displacing petroleum, it was a drop in the barrel.
Yeah. Well, let's talk then about what can make more than a drop in the barrel. What would be some of the more significant changes that could take place? And whether or not, Severin Bornstein, we have the technology to do that. Right now, as I understand it, we only get about 6% of our energy needs through renewable sources, meaning wind and solar and hydro and the rest. Are we getting closer to making a bigger dent, a bigger drop in that bucket?
Clear distinction when we start our energy-related CO2 emissions between transportation energy, what we do with our cars, and electricity. On the electricity side, there are a lot of options that are growing quite rapidly, that are becoming more economic, and that I think we could start to use on much greater scale. There is no question, though, they are more expensive than using fossil fuels if we continue to pretend the only cost of using fossil fuels is the actual direct cost of burning them. Until we confront the reality of the cost of CO2, fossil fuels always win. These renewables are not that cheap, and they're not going to get that cheap over the next few decades. On the transportation side, things are much more challenging because when you try to use energy in a car, you can't hook it up to an electric grid, and so your choices are very limited, and you have to figure out some way to store the energy. And unfortunately, it turns out gasoline is just an incredibly efficient way to store energy. So far, the storage technologies haven't really caught up. So there, we're really faced with a much greater challenge. There are some steps in the right direction, and certainly we are improving. Some of these hybrid vehicles can now go many miles. But I think that the choices are harder there. It's going to be more costly. But I think right off the bat, we have to recognize that there isn't going to be a way to confront this if we're going to stick to the view that energy has to stay as cheap as we have pretended it's been over the last decade.
Well, what does that mean in policy consequences, Severin Bornstein? Does that mean that we need a different sort of tax system? What does that mean that in terms of being able to really recognize what you call the true cost?
Well, I think it means that we need to recognize the cost of CO2 emissions either through a tax on CO2 or more likely through a tradable permit system that says that you have to have a permit in order to emit CO2, and those permits are allocated, and then companies and users who can reduce their CO2 emissions can resell them and make money off them. Companies that don't reduce have to buy them. And this is an economic concept that was sort of considered this strange economist dream back in the 70s, and now is in broad use. We've used it to reduce SO2 emissions. We've used it to reduce NOx emissions, both of which contribute to local air pollution and smog. So this is a concept that has been well tested. Applying it to CO2 is going to be much more challenging, and that's because CO2 is a global problem. It's not a local pollutant. So to get a handle on this, we're going to have to implement a system that isn't just California, although I think California does have to lead by example, but isn't just the U.S., but includes all of the world, including the developing world, that is rapidly ramping up its emissions of CO2.
Well, let's stay with the cap-and-trade business, because that comes up frequently, and it's sometimes a little bit of a difficult concept to get your head around. So help us through that, Terry Tamminen. Basically, as I understand cap-and-trade, it means that you set a certain level for which emissions are capped, and those that stay below that can actually trade some of their credits to other companies that are struggling to do that. But the purpose is to provide a sort of economic incentive to keep that at a certain point. Do you concur that that's where we really need to go next, Terry?
Well, that's definitely one of the more important tools. As Severin mentioned, it's been used successfully before. And I actually think it works well in the very fact that the point that he made about the fact that CO2 and other greenhouse gases are global, that actually works in your favor with a trading system, as Governor Schwarzenegger has recently done when we met with Tony Blair and as he's done when he went to New York and met with the states that have a regional greenhouse gas initiative in the Northeast. He and other governors are trying to set up collaborations with, say, the European Union that's already doing trading to make sure that as we develop some kind of a market-based system, that it can communicate, if you will, sort of like currency exchange. You know, you might have different currencies in your country, but as long as you know what the exchange rate is, you know, that's okay, and coordinate with other parts of the United States. So that this becomes a global market to solve a global problem. And it's not the only tool. And certainly you have to start with some kind of a target. That's, of course, one of the many things that was missing from the president's speech the other night, is that, you know, you must have some kind of a cap and some kind of a clear goal. Otherwise, a trading system can't work.
But Vicky Arroyo, so far caps have been sort of no-go on Capitol Hill, right? Give us the sort of Washington perspective on that and what the odds are that something could happen on a base that goes beyond just a state-by-state point of view.
Sure. I mean, there actually have been proposals from, for example, Senators McCain and Lieberman for some time now on a cap-and-trade for greenhouse gas pollution. My colleagues are right in saying that we've done this domestically for sulfur dioxide and other air pollutants, and actually Europe is moving forward with their own cap-and-trade system to meet their Kyoto target for greenhouse gases. So this is being done. It's being developed by the states in the New England area and Mid-Atlantic as well with a regional trading program, but I agree that this really is most cost-effective and best at a federal level, and then something that could eventually link with the international program post-Kyoto. So there are some proposals. Really, we're seeing new proposals almost every week, it seems like now, on Capitol Hill. It did start with McCain and Lieberman, but Sanders Boxer have a proposal to cap and reduce emissions over time. Senators Kerry and Snow, Senators Feinstein and Carper, Senator Bingaman. There are many, many proposals now on the Hill to address greenhouse gases. The question is, you know, will they get enough votes to succeed? And will this president, who has traditionally not taken a leadership role on climate, be willing to sign any of this into legislation? Just a few words about the commitments that, or the statements, I should say, that he made during the State of the Union. I mean, that was really regarding the transportation sector and not these other important sources like electricity generation, manufacturing, encouraging efficient appliances, and that kind of thing. And at best, the targets that he set were really aimed more at restricting the growth in emissions. So while they were often reported as a 20% reduction in gasoline use, that might not translate into a climate benefit depending on what other fuels you use, but it's also off of projected growth. So it's really not a reduction from today's levels. It's really more a projection of the future levels and a reduction to today's levels from those levels at best.
Vicky Arroyo is joining us this morning. She's Director of Policy Analysis for the Pew Center for Global Climate Change. Along with Terry Tamminen, Governor Schwarzenegger's former Secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency, and Severin Bornstein, Director of the Energy Institute at the University of California, Berkeley. They'll continue to stay with us throughout our hour this morning, but we want to get an additional perspective on this issue now from the business point of view. And so joining us for just a few moments is Dorothy Rothrock. She's Vice President for Government Relations at the California Manufacturers and Technology Association. Ms. Rothrock, thanks for joining us.
Oh, sure.
Give us your sense of the sort of business perspective on this, because ever since the landmark legislation known as AB 32 was passed and by the California legislature and signed by Governor Schwarzenegger, pointing us towards a reduction of greenhouse gases by some 25% in the coming years, one of the concerns that's often been expressed has been from the business point of view, and it has to do in part, but fill us in on this, that businesses don't like uncertainty, and there is some uncertainty about how this goal is going to be achieved and what the impact of that is going to be on businesses. So what's the point of view that you're trying to make sure gets heard in Sacramento right now?
Thanks for the opportunity to say my piece here, because it's very important for everybody involved in the debate to know that the business community really wants this goal to be achieved and implemented correctly in California. We've got really two goals, if you want to talk about it this way, of AB 32, and that is to reduce emissions as well as grow the California economy. And we know that if we don't grow the California economy, if industrial growth happens elsewhere in other regions and other countries, then we will not have actually achieved the reductions goal that we all have. This is a global issue, and simply making California a higher cost state and having industrial production move elsewhere won't solve any problem. It won't help the California economy, obviously.
Is the heart of your concern then in part that if California goes it alone to an extent and our neighboring states do not follow suit, that it inherently puts California businesses and farms and at a competitive disadvantage?
It definitely could, and that's what the business group that's come together is trying to help the CARB and legislators avoid as a result of this. So we have a series of principles that we hope that the regulators stick to as they're going through the implementation process so that that does not happen. For example, we believe that so long as the regulations that are adopted are cost-effective, then that will not raise costs on business, and it will encourage them to expand and stay in California. We also believe that to reduce the regulatory uncertainty will also encourage companies to expand, because we have the time period now between when regulations actually go into effect is many years, but we have companies today and tomorrow and next month making investment decisions, and that uncertainty is creating a big question mark on their analysis. And we don't want that specter of cost to be so high that they're disinclined to make their investments in California.
Let me just follow up on that point in particular, because it seems to me there's a built-in dilemma there. It's totally understandable from a business point of view that you want to know what the playing field is so you can make smart investment decisions. On the other hand, obviously, you don't want to rush your way into regulation, that that's going to take a certain amount of consideration, thought, and planning. So how do you come down on that? Are you on the side of sort of wanting to get this resolved as soon as possible, or do you feel like it's, although it's there's a business reason why that's problematic to take that time, that you still need to do that?
It's definitely a balancing act, and we know that it's hard to do, but that's the position we're in now because of the way the bill is structured and the timeline that's set up. We believe that we can reduce the uncertainty, not necessarily get rid of it altogether, but you can certainly reduce the uncertainty by having the regulators take whatever steps they can take in terms of acknowledging where they are going to move, the principles they're going to apply, the structure they're going to put on the way they analyze companies or industrial sectors, so that the companies themselves can make the determination, mm-hmm. okay, it looks like this is the way they're going, so now I feel comfortable that I can make this decision and not be subject to some bad result coming on down the line.
Dorothy Rothrock, Vice President for Government Relations at the California Manufacturers and Technology Association. Thanks very much for adding your perspective to this debate this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're going to have to take a break of our own in just a moment. But Severin Bornstein, if you would, I'd be curious to get your perspective on some of the issues that Dorothy Rothrock outlined, because it again gets to this question of the role of states and versus the role of the federal government, and whether or not there are some risks for California being always the trendsetter.
I think there are some risks. I think that Dorothy's absolutely right that strict regulations in California will raise costs here relative to producers elsewhere, and we have to be careful about that. On the other hand, I think that if we combine it with an emphasis on creating the technologies that can address the climate change challenge, we could offset that to some extent. Still, I think that we have to recognize the purpose of California taking the lead on this cannot be that we are somehow going to solve the problem or even significantly affect it on our own. We have to be thinking about leading by example, getting the rest of the country to follow along. So we have to think about scale. Whatever we do, we have to think about the scalability of it up to the federal level and then up to the international level. Because if we don't accomplish that, California on its own is not going to change this issue, and I think it could create some real problems. We have to be cognizant of the cost it imposes on the California economy.
Severin Bornstein, Director of the Energy Institute at the University of California, Berkeley. And when we return, Severin Bornstein, along with Terry Tamminen and Vicky Arroyo, will take your calls. We're also going to get an environmentalist perspective on all of this after our break. If you're interested in participating in our discussion, here's how to do that. You can call us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your questions at forum@kqed.org. Again, the email address, it's forum@kqed.org. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, climate change, global warming, and what policy initiatives make a difference. There's been a lot in the news, both in California and around the country in recent days and weeks, and we're trying to put all of that in some sort of perspective this morning. Joining us to do that, Severin Bornstein, Director of the Energy Institute at the University of California, Berkeley. Vicky Arroyo, Director of Policy Analysis for the Pew Center for Global Climate Change in Washington, and Terry Tamminen, Governor Schwarzenegger's former secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency and author of Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction. And we'll take your calls as well in just a moment. Here again is the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your thoughts, observations, and questions at forum at kqed.org. But we're going to start out our second half hour by getting an additional perspective on this from Bill Gallegos. He's executive director of the Citizens for a Better Environment. Bill, thanks for joining us. Give us your perspective about what concerns you, if anything, about this particular aspect of climate change, which has to do with the idea of capping and trading, which we were talking about some in our first half hour, the idea that we should put some caps on certain companies and then allow them to trade those credits back and forth so that overall you're meeting a certain goal. I know your organization has some particular concerns about that approach. What are they?
Thanks, Dave. Just a correction. It's Communities for a Better Environment.
I'm sorry. My apologies.
That's okay. Generally, there's been a consensus in the environmental justice community against cap-and-trade programs, and that's because the evidence shows, and it validates our concerns, that it exacerbates problems in low-income communities of color. And, for example, we had a program in Los Angeles called Reclaim, which was a trading program. It was a market mechanism trading program, and it significantly increased problems in areas like Wilmington, which are significantly overpolluted, have a high concentration of polluting sources already, and so therefore just added to the already significant health problems caused by environmental pollution in that area, where there's oil refineries and chrome platers and manufacturing and power plants and they're very near the harbor, which is the largest, the ports, the largest polluting source in the region. So we're really concerned that, you know, by taking this approach rather than alternative approaches, we're going to make the problem worse for low-income communities in the United States and communities of the Global South.
And does that extend, Bill Gallegos, to this question then of trading within greenhouse gases? Is your concern that what your experience has been in Southern California will also then apply to big power plants, that they're going to be the ones who are going to be less likely to abide by certain standards and so will acquire those trading credits and continue to pollute, and that the brunt of that will be borne by those lower income communities?
Exactly. You know, I'll give you an example. Here in the Los Angeles area, there's a small community called Vernon, which actually is a very little weird industrial community that has about 100 residents. The city of Vernon wants to build a 900-megawatt power plant. That's in the southeast Los Angeles region, which I referred to earlier, which is significantly has a high concentration, over-concentration of polluting sources. And now they want to add a coal-fired power plant. It's about the size of two baseball fields, 900 megawatts. And to get their application, to have their application accepted, they had to get a change from the AQMD to the priority reserve rule. But the priority reserve rule, it's actually a pollution credit system that applies to emergency services like hospitals and schools. So if there's an emergency, they can crank up their emergency system, even though that system may be polluting. So they have amended the priority reserve rule to allow power plants to access to these credits. So the situation just gets worse and worse and worse. So we oppose the amendment to the rule. We didn't like the first rule in the first place. We don't like the credit system.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then when they don't even play by the rules on that, they're saying, okay, we're going to amend the system so that it doesn't just apply to emergency services, but to allow them to set up new power plants. Actually, there's 9 new power plants on the drawing boards in the Southern California region. So we think that this is really a bad, bad idea and a bad approach towards solving the problems of global warming and environmental pollution.
Bill, thanks. Thanks very much. It's an important perspective to get, and I'm really glad that we could add it to our program this morning. Bill Gallegos, Executive Director of Communities for a Better Environment. Thanks for being part of our program. We want to get your calls on this topic as well. Before we do that, though, a quick observation or response to the really interesting point that Mr. Gallegos raises, Terry Tamminen, because I'm not sure it's always on our radar screen when we talk about this topic. Your thoughts?
Well, he raises very, very important points, although some are directly relevant to this global warming concern and some are not. We were very concerned about the environmental justice implications, and in AB 32, we put in strong language that Mr. Gallegos and others helped us craft that says that if you're going to allow trading, if you're going to allow essentially relatively more emissions of CO2 in one place in order to get less somewhere else or in total overall get less, that we cannot in any way backslide on criteria pollutants. You can't use this as an excuse or a Trojan horse to then backslide on the concerns that he has about increased pollution being in a particular neighborhood. And so that's one of the concerns, just as Dorothy Rothrock raised, about also being sure that measures we take are cost-effective. That was one that the business community helped us craft into AB 32. So I think that as we go forward, other states are looking at this as well and making sure that if there is a trading program, that it does not create a disproportionate impact on communities, because remember, CO2 in and of itself does not harm anyone as they breathe it.
So as we keep our eyes on the climate change prize, it's really important to sort of consider all these other consequences and ramifications, whether it be for farms, for businesses, or low-income communities.
Absolutely.
Let's open up our conversation to our listeners and emailers this morning. Again, the number 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. Let's go first to Diane, who joins us this morning on the Sirius Satellite Network in Mount Clemens, Michigan. Diane, go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon to you. My objection is to the statement that the business community must be given guidelines and time to plan that they will make, to be able to make the rational decisions that they have to. If they were making good rational decisions, they would not be handing out golden parachutes in the amounts of $200 or $400 million. They could easily put money aside so that they can deal with what has to be done to protect our environment. And
yeah.
I also would not accept the premise that small businesses would be hurt by environmental actions, because they are so often exempt from this type of thing. So that's my thinking
All
here
right.
in air-dirty Michigan.
All right. The heart of the auto industry. Diane, thanks very much for calling and participating in our program. Vicky Royo, again, to this question of whether or not have we come to a sort of tipping point in the way we look at this topic now, where it's no longer viewed that what's good for the environment is necessarily bad for the economy, that the two, in fact, can go hand in hand. Is that really at the heart of the coalition that you saw come forward this week?
Sure. It's definitely at the heart of not only the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, which announced its presence on Monday with these recommendations, but also the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, where I work, because we have a Business Environmental Leadership Council, which also includes 42 of the leading companies, Fortune 100 companies, that say enough is known about the science to take action, and that we can take action without it harming them economically. In fact, there are some real opportunities that come from developing new technologies. And to the argument that Diane was just responding to about business certainty, I think she's right. And I think business certainty can play out many ways, and the need to have some federal regulatory certainty is very important. And it's what prompted several of the CEOs on Monday to call for federal action. They see a future where carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions are constrained, and they would like to know what those constraints are at the federal level as they make big investment decisions now. And so I guess what I would tell Dorothy from California is, if the California manufacturers and others want regulatory certainty, then please come to Washington and let the leaders know that.
Yeah. And to Chuck next, who joins us this morning from across the bay in Oakland. Chuck, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. How are you this morning? I think the one thing the president didn't hit on, and I think the one thing that people really don't discuss in the state of California, is the personal responsibility of the people who live here and leave to work and leave their lights on in their houses and increase this demand upon all of these facilities and natural gas burning stations and all these things that burn and make all the environmental problems we have. If we were to put a little bit more emphasis on letting the communities say, do your part to help out the country in knocking these demand down so we don't need to build new power plants and that type of thing, I think we could do a lot better in the future. I mean, all the president would have to say is, could everybody in America turn a light off tonight?
Yeah, Yeah.
You know, and we would have moved ourselves 10 feet farther than we
yeah.
are.
Great point, Chuck. Thanks for joining us and making that observation. It's true, Severin Bornstein. A colleague of mine here at KQED a number of months ago chastised me for leaving my lights on when I would come down to the radio studio, and so I've tried to be a better citizen about that in recent months. Can those sort of individual actions really make a difference? We've talked earlier in the program about that the president's proposal on changing fuel efficiency standards was just a drop in the bucket. Is turning off lights another drop in the bucket, or do those sorts of individual actions really make a difference?
Well, I think in aggregate, those sorts of individual actions on improving energy efficiency and conservation make a huge difference. And in fact, the evidence is that's where the low-hanging fruit is. If we really want to reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases, the simplest and least cost way to do it is to reduce our energy use through very low-cost changes. Now, I don't think that relying on individual responsibility on its own is going to get us there. I think that people on their own, without some incentive, don't tend to pay attention to things that are cheap to them. So that if electricity is really cheap, people leave the lights on, sometimes for their convenience, sometimes just out of thoughtlessness. We have to give people both the tools to do it and the incentive to do it. And that means moving technology forward so that we have better ways for people to save energy, for instance, through better, more efficient light bulbs, and through changing the pricing so that people realize it's really expensive when you do things that cause CO2 emissions.
And we have to invest in that technology. There was an interesting story in the New York Times a few weeks ago about the, I can't remember the official name of it, but an alternative or renewable energy center established under the Carter administration
right.
in Colorado that has been consistently underfunded for the last 30 years.
That's right. The funding for research in general into energy efficiency and alternative energies has been really very weak, and it has gotten a lot weaker under the Bush administration. A year ago, when the president declared we were addicted to oil, he then actually made a trip to the National Renewable Energy Lab in Colorado, and they had to quickly rehire some of the people they had been laying off because of
yeah.
budget cuts from the Bush administration. So we are still really underfunding the research, and that's where we really need to put the money, rather than putting it into some of the current technologies that really aren't there yet. We have to get the science breakthrough, so we really need to have the research that's going to improve our energy situation on both the supply side and on the demand side to improve the efficiency with which we use energy.
Some of our listener emails coming in, John writes, all the alternative energy and technology aimed at limiting global warming will be dwarfed by our ever-expanding consumerism demanding by the god of economic growth. An environmentally finite planet can't support infinite economic growth. Maggie writes, thanks for the excellent program. Could Terry explain the measures that the California Public Utilities Commission has been taking on regarding energy efficiency and greenhouse gas reduction? News about that just this morning, Terry, about steps that the Public Utilities Commission had taken, both in terms of dry cleaning solvents, but also saying that California can no longer import electricity that's derived from high polluting sources. How important are those initiatives?
Well, very important, as a lot of focus was paid on AB 32, our recent climate legislation. At the same time, the legislature passed and the governor signed AB 1368, which is what the Public Utilities Commission is responding to yesterday, which says that California utilities will not be allowed to purchase coal-fired or other polluting energy from outside the state. Unless it meets at least the cleanest standard that we now have for natural gas and that it sequesters carbon. So that sends a good market signal to investors to start investing in what's called IGCC technology for coal and to experiment with sequestration. But more hopefully it sends the message that we should be developing wind and geothermal and solar and other renewables. And that they can then more fairly compete to the point that Severin's been making, that we really need to internalize
yeah.
all these external costs that fossil fuels have been getting away with for years.
And to more of our callers, let's go next to Patrick, who joins us from Kentfield this morning. Patrick, go ahead.
Hi. I was curious about something one of your guests said earlier as far as burning ethanol, and I assume we're talking also about biodiesel and things like that. And he said that it doesn't reduce the amount of CO2, and I understand that from the fact that when you burn these things, they combust and form CO2. But wouldn't the use of that start to create a zero-sum game in the carbon cycle and the fact that plants grow using CO2? I mean, wouldn't that at least be one of the ways to help lower CO2 emissions?
Patrick, thank you. Thanks for the question. It is something that got a lot of attention in the president's address, the idea that we should increase by fivefold our use of ethanol. But there's been a fair amount of controversy about really whether or not ethanol is such a great idea. I think the biodiesel question is a little separate, but Severin, I believe you raised that, so I'll let you have a go at it.
Alex Farrell, a researcher, professor at UC Berkeley, has done what I think is the definitive study on this that looks at the full life cycle effect of ethanol and finds that although using ethanol from corn reduces oil use quite a bit, what it ends up using is a lot of other fossil fuel energy sources, natural gas and coal-fired electricity, in order to produce the ethanol. So the problem is not the plant energy itself. That indeed is sort of a closed cycle and doesn't produce any additional CO2. But the fertilizers and the transportation and all of that that go into making the ethanol. And unfortunately, the best estimates are that when you count all of that stuff, using ethanol, and recognize that ethanol per gallon has 15% less energy in it, using ethanol actually only reduces greenhouse gas production by about 15 to 20%. Now, biofuels are a very different case, and it depends what the source is, how it's grown, and how it's transported, and some of it is much more promising than ethanol. But the corn lobby is pushing ethanol, obviously, for their own benefit, and it does help if what you're trying to do is reduce dependence on oil. But it does not help much if what you're trying to do is reduce greenhouse gas production.
Let's squeeze in another call if we can as time grows short as we approach the end of our hour. Next to Sydney, who joins us in Berkeley this morning. Sydney, go ahead.
A question for Severin Bornstein or one of your other panel members. In the recent Scientific American, there was a little sidebar article about Spectralab, which is a company mostly funded by DOE. They are talking about solar conversion factors on photovoltaic cells that they make for spacecraft, little teeny ones, but conversion factors of around 40.7%, which is double than 14 to 20% we're currently getting. I wonder if this is real, and I wonder if he thinks this is potentially replicatable on some larger scale that we could use.
Yeah, Sydney, thank you. We're unfortunately approaching the end of this hour in what is really a fascinating and important discussion. So let me use Sydney's question as a way to have you each, I guess, take a crack at whether it's solar, whether it's ethanol, whether it's biodiesel, whether it's none of those things, and it's an entirely different approach. But speak to what you think the most important thing is for us to focus on, both as citizens, but also for our elected leaders. Severin, take a crack at that first, please.
Well, I think in the short run, what we need to do is reduce our use of energy, both through conservation and through improved energy efficiency. That is the thing we can do most quickly to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and that means raising fuel efficiency standards, using electricity more efficiently, obviously trying to build fewer coal plants and moving more towards natural gas, which does produce less CO2. Unfortunately, the current technologies for solar photovoltaics are really not even close to cost competitive. Wind is in some situations, and I think we need to be moving towards that as well. But in the medium and longer run, we need to be funding research on the sorts of ideas like the caller just mentioned. I'm not familiar with that one, but there are a lot of exciting technologies that convert solar energy to electricity. And we need to have some science breakthroughs so that those become much closer to cost competitive. Now, they shouldn't have to get all the way down to the cost of fossil fuels because those prices don't include the CO2 damage that they're doing. But we do have to bring those costs down substantially, and the way we're going to do that is through funding the research for science breakthroughs, not through rolling out the current technologies. So that's where we really need to go when we're planning towards the medium and longer run. And obviously, greenhouse gases and global warming is not a problem just for this year or next year. It's a problem for decades to come. So we need to be focused on solving the problem over the next many decades.
Severin Bornstein joined us this hour, as well as Terry Tamminen and Vicky Arroyo. Our discussion is going to continue in just a moment as we continue our conversation on this topic. But as many of you are no doubt aware, this is Pledge Week on Public Radio, a time when we ask our listeners, both here locally in San Francisco and in Sacramento, for their support. So for those of you listening on the Sirius Satellite Network, our discussion will continue in a moment. We ask our guests and our callers to stay with us as our discussion continues. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Let's take another caller now from Aman, who joins us in San Francisco. Aman, go ahead.
Hi, I have a quick question for you. I believe one of your callers mentioned that it is significantly more difficult to control greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles that are moving rather than from sort of central electrical stations. And I'm wondering how that plays into the idea of using more mass transit, which is not really ever discussed much in California, which has a real love affair with the car.
Yeah, great question, Aman. Thank you. Terry Tamminen.
To reduce the vehicle miles traveled, and that's one of the reasons that in the recent bond package, although it wasn't noted, but we passed almost over $50 billion worth of bonds in the November 7th election, and a very significant percentage of that in the transportation side was for mass transit, which is something states don't normally get involved in. It's local taxes, local revenues that pay for the mass transit, but the governor understands that and wants to ramp up our mass transit use. So that is something we're going to have to address nationally as well.
Holly emails in this question. Please have your guests address the pros and cons of voluntary versus mandatory greenhouse gas control measures, including in the area of offsets, measures to offset emissions rather than to reduce them directly. Vicky Arroyo, is that something you can respond to?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to. Voluntary measures, we've had them at this country in the federal level since the first President Bush, and we've seen our emissions grow considerably in that time. So rather than reaching a Kyoto target that the United States negotiated for, although didn't move forward with, of 7% below 1990 levels, we're actually about 16% above 1990 levels at this point. And that is in spite of the existence of several voluntary programs that the administration has announced with companies and sectors even. So clearly, voluntary isn't working to get absolute reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, which we absolutely need. We need a mandatory policy. And offsets are something that can be used in a flexible way, just as emissions trading, as we've discussed in this program, to sort of soften the burden in terms of the cost of the policy. So these could be through things like investing in planting trees and things like that, that can also capture and sequester or store, if you will, some of the carbon dioxide in the soils and lands. These are part of the solution, but they're not a panacea. We really do need policies that push new technologies and actually push deployment of those technologies into the market.
And Emily joins us next from San Francisco, and she has an idea about a solution, too. Emily, go ahead. Emily, are you with us?
Hi. Yes. Well, just to go off of what Vicky was saying, just that among the many things that California can do to fight climate change is to recognize the climate benefits of forests and land-based more generally. So just as trees absorb CO2 and store it as biomass as they grow, they also release CO2 into the atmosphere when the trees are removed for development and other kind of uses. So
right.
California has a great opportunity to address climate change by conserving its forests and managing them to store more carbon.
Emily, thank you. It's in an article I read recently, Terry Tamminen, it was sort of astounding, actually, what 1 acre of forest actually does in terms of reducing or sucking back in, I guess, CO2s. And it brings us back again to this point of what we ought to focus on, whether it's planting a tree or putting dollars into research. Give us your sense of sort of how we ought best focus on doing something about climate change.
Well, I think the most important first step and single most important step of the climate work in California is setting a goal. If you don't know where you're going, all roads will take you there. And we really have to get the United States to collectively understand what California has now said, which is that we must reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050 if we hope to avoid some of the worst consequences that we currently anticipate, and to do our fair share in the world community here. So I think that's number one. Number two, I would go to the point that Severin made about investing in R&D. and investing in balancing some of the equations that we have right now. The Congress recently acted, at least in the House of Representatives, to reduce the subsidies we give to the oil industry by $14 billion. Well, according to my calculations in my recent book, Lives Per Gallon, we currently subsidize them to the tune of $114 billion every single year in direct subsidies and tax breaks. And that's the reason that things like gasoline are artificially low priced, and that we, in fact, need to end those subsidies, take some of that money and put it back into health care to deal with the health consequences of our air pollution, as well as into dealing with CO2 and the climate change issue. But we must start with a target, which has to be legislated, I believe, into a cap. Otherwise, as you've heard, voluntary measures are not going to get us there, and we now are in a fairly urgent and desperate situation, as we hear from Jim Hansen at NASA and others. We've got a short period of time to deal with this, and we have an administration that right now the house is on fire and the president is mowing the lawn.
Hmm. Severin Borstein, last quick thought. We just have 30 seconds or so, but where you come down, I guess, on optimism versus pessimism, and what would edge you, I guess, more on the optimistic side? What would it take for you to feel like we're finally coming to terms with the fact that we need to do more than mow the lawn?
Well, I think that we are seeing more and more widespread acceptance of the need to do something. It hasn't made it to the White House yet, but it is making it into more areas, and there's increasing evidence. Unfortunately, it is going to take some real coordinated effort, not just across the United States, but across the globe. And so far, that looks like a huge challenge still, but we got to get started on it now, or we're not going to make it in time. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we're starting to see movement in the right direction, but it really needs to pick up steam.
And on that cautiously optimistic note, we will close our program. Our thanks to Severin Borstein, Director of the Energy Institute at the University of California, Berkeley. Severin, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Terry Tamminen joined us as well from the now an energy consultant, author of Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction, former Secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency. Terry, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Vicky Arroyo was with us as well, Director of Policy Analysis for the Pew Center for Global Climate Change. Vicky Arroyo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.